America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. America finds itself in seeming perpetual conflict around the globe, or at least on guard in three-quarters of the countries on Earth, just in case. Most Americans seem oblivious to the far-flung military its tax dollars support. That long-envisioned peace dividend won't come due even in the wake of our hasty exit from Afghanistan. It appears that our offensive defense posture assures that we will be in low-grade conflicts for the foreseeable future. And in our guest's view, we're resigned to that and ready to stay mobilized for what he calls more humane war. What is that? We'll talk about it today on America Trends.
With us on American Trends is Samuel Moring, and he's written a book called Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. And you have so many provocative thoughts in this book about America and its conduct on the international stage. And let me start with something early in the book. You say endless war has become part of the American way of life, or the way Americans live now. Is that something that we need to accept? Is that something that the role of a guarantor of world order requires America to be involved with?
I hope not, Larry. Thanks for having me. We first have to define our terms. In a certain way, America has always been at war since there were colonists fighting Indians. America really pivoted to a kind of global role in the 1940s. It had an overseas empire in the Philippines and fought a brutal war there at the turn of the 20th century. My question is, what happened at the end of the Cold War when, in theory, we could have taken another path and put all of that behind us? Well, we ended up entering a war on terror, and I've written a book that's really about the way a frightening new form of war emerged from the war on terror, as our initial invasions in Afghanistan and Iraq were wound down, and we began to devise a permanent form of security that involves drones and special forces in lots of places and with no end date. And that's the endless war that we're fighting now. And it's the one I've tried to kind of put in historical perspective in the book.
And you have, believe me, to anyone listening, you really need to pick this up if you really want to have an understanding of America's role in the world. You remind us that the U.S. has made a clear choice to make war more humane. Having said that, we have special forces deployed in more than three-quarters of the countries on the planet. And I did another interview, I believe it was with Bing West, who has been in conflict many years. And I think he reminded me that we had only been out of any hot conflict this country in the last 40 years for about 46 days, period.
So in a way, the endlessness of the war is not new, but in our day that we've really done something remarkable with war. In the old days, war may have been endless, but Americans fought it brutally, and they really didn't object to doing so. After Vietnam and the My Lai revelations, mm-hmm. Americans began to demand, and the military began to accept a new form of constraint on the way our troops fight or our drone strike. And this is the thing that worries me about, let's call it the current form of the endless war. It includes special forces too. It's that there are rules that make sure, at least that's the hope, that there isn't torture, that there isn't too much civilian death or other collateral damage. And I wrote this book really because I heard President Barack Obama kind of explain to me in some speeches that the humanity of the war now makes it okay. And so I looked back and I wondered, are there any off-ramps to this? Or do we have to accept a kind of highway into the future of now humane endless war?
When you look at it, Americans have also really been disconnected from many of the impacts of war. I used to do a radio program in the midst of our involvement in Afghanistan, and there were certain mornings I would ask, has anybody thought today about our troops in Afghanistan? Is anybody thinking that we're at war? Is it having any impact on your life? And the answer was clearly no. But Americans say they wanted to get out of Afghanistan, as we recently did, and yet they were so, well, not really focused on it for such a long period of time.
That's absolutely right, Larry. I mean, there's a funny way in which Americans know and don't want to know about the global involvement of the military that we all pay for. I'd argue that, you know, one of the most neglected facts about the last 20 years is that presidential elections have turned on knowing that we're at war and hoping that it could stop. So George W. Bush had the country with him when he started the first form of the war on terror by invading Afghanistan and Iraq with big armies. But he lost credibility, and Barack Obama ran against war. Donald Trump ran against war. Joe Biden ran against war. And the troubling thing is that, for one thing, once they're in office, these anti-war candidates become endless war presidents, but they also withdraw troops. And now Biden's finished the job in Afghanistan, only to perpetuate the war with little bands of men and special forces or armed drones or standoff missiles. So I just wish that the presidents who are clearly, you know, aware that the people want a stop to war would kind of take that insight even further.
But when we look at how far flung the United States is all across the globe, we've got, of course, the carriers that no one else has. We've got bases everywhere. We're deployed in service of various treaties that we have to protect our allies. I mean, how do we avoid conflict given the way that we have projected our strength around the world?
Well, you're right that those old features of American ascendancy, which really date from our entry into World War II and especially the Cold War and Korean Wars, have been baked in. And I'd add to that just the military procurement system, which grinds on and on. You know, one of the most remarkable things was that when the two political parties were at each other's throats around Donald Trump's first impeachment, they just took a break and voted almost unanimously in their annual ritual for the National Defense Authorization bill that funds the defense to the tune of trillions in an amount that, you know, is more than the next eight countries on the list combined. And so it's just hard to imagine undoing that old history. And yet the new things we're doing count too. And it's a place to start thinking, do we want to not have troops engaged in combat, maybe sitting on bases or sitting in rooms with joysticks, but patrolling the whole world and surveilling the whole world? Is that the way we'd like to be treated? If you have ideas for how we can go back to the 1940s and 50s and undo our choice, as you put it, to be everywhere. I'd love to hear it. The thing is, from a base, you can only do a limited amount. With electronic surveillance and drones anywhere, you can actually kill and you can scare in ways that seem like they're new and they're permanent.
Okay, so we're talking now when we're out of Afghanistan, but we're told, don't worry, if there's any bases being developed by terrorists, we'll know about it because we've got an over-the-horizon strategy. How far over the horizon and how involved are we going to still be in the skies of Afghanistan, for example?
Very. You know, Joe Biden in his main address to the American people defending his, I think, honorable choice to complete the withdrawal from Afghanistan that actually Obama started and Trump struggled to complete. He used that phrase, over the horizon. Now, we shouldn't deny that it is hard on the CIA and the military to organize strikes when they have to send the drones a far distance rather than a short one. But we know that even before the disorderly withdrawal from Afghanistan, there were efforts to find new bases in neighboring countries. And that's because it's only expectable that with Taliban rule, we'll see the return of more terrorist threats than before. And during the withdrawal, the strike by ISIS-K was an excellent example. And so my sense is that Biden had the promise that we'd continue to do this. The underlying question is this, though. Have we used drones and special forces to keep ourselves safe or to perpetuate new terrorist threats? I mean, most of the studies suggest that counterterrorism is counterproductive and other countries don't have or need it to the extent we do, and they don't abuse international law going into countries that haven't invited them either. And so my question is it good enough that we keep our drones and special forces humane to let them keep doing what they're doing?
The book is called Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. Samuel Moyne, who's a professor at Yale University of both law and history. I'm glad that you brought that up about counterterrorism, because as we looked on the 20th anniversary of what is now a long war on terror, I hear a lot of commentators, left and right, saying, wow, what a success this counterterrorism is and has been. Look, we haven't had attacks on our homeland since 9/11, at least in the way that attack was so pervasive and so dramatic and so disturbing. So the question is, what about this war on terror that we have been deploying and that we are still guarding against and that all of these expenditures are going toward without much debate, as you said, in Congress?
Well, it's a tough question, Larry, and I think, you know, just having discussion about it is so important. It's only fair to say that the American homeland hasn't been struck in the 20 years since September 11th, 2001. On the other hand, it wasn't struck in the 200 years before September 11th, 2001. Unless you count Pearl Harbor, which, while a significant event, was in at what was at the time a territory out far out in the Pacific, part of what at the time was a Pacific empire. And so you really have to go back to the founding era when there were actual threats to the homeland that were realized. So we're talking about one over a very long period of time. Now, needless to say, terrorists are real and threats are real. The only question we have to ask is, do we have better, more productive ways of interdicting those threats that don't require us to send these drones and surveillance technologies as if, you know, we could ever achieve permanent security? And that's what interested me in Barack Obama, because even as he repeatedly said the humanity of the endless war makes it okay. He also tried to say that not a lot of people die from terrorism. It's more of a regulatory problem, like, you know, traffic accidents or slipping in the bathtub, both of which claim many more American lives than terrorism ever has. And he wanted somehow to get Americans to give up the fear that is driving this, along with all the other factors we expressed before. But ultimately, he chose not to try to educate them in that way. And I'm wondering if it's time to get a leader who does so.
It's interesting because you talk about the fact that we bemoan any war crimes and we do react to them. My Lai was a good example of that and the horrific nature of that and the response in America. We saw Abu Ghraib. But we look at war crimes and we find them detestable, but we don't find the act of war detestable. Thus, you know, this notion of a more humane war where we're taking fewer prisoners, we're not torturing people, kind of an antiseptic approach to war, much along the lines of what we were talking about, where if you turn your head, it all looks antiseptic because you're not paying any attention to it. And, of course, in Afghanistan, there were a lot of civilians killed, but later on you tell us that we got better at being much more focused about how we targeted those that we really found ourselves engaged with. So what is humane war as you look at it? Because I know we have a lot of treaties and we have international accords, but that doesn't stop a nation when it's determined that it's going to go forward. It didn't stop us going into Iraq, even though we had truly no reason to go in.
Absolutely. So, you know, my book is really a story of two different bodies of laws that we have in the world. One prohibits going to war in documents that Americans wrote, like the United Nations Charter. And another set of rules tells you how you can fight, what you can't do, what weapons you can't use, how much collateral damage you can cause if you're already in war. And, you know, just for our consideration, I do try to look very far back and recover how influential Americans were in calling for the kind of peaceful order that ended up leading to the United Nations Charter for all its faults. And, you know, I look at events like the Nuremberg trials, which really were about condemning Adolf Hitler's henchmen for starting World War II, not so much for the vile acts they perpetrated. Even in Vietnam, all the debate around the war, or let's say much of the debate, concerned whether it was a good idea and legal under the United Nations Charter to be there, not whether our troops were conducting themselves brutally. And when My Lai was revealed, actually it was extremely controversial, with a lot of people finding it outrageous that Lieutenant William Calley could be prosecuted. However, for the anti-war movement, they used atrocity news as kind of fuel for the fire of their concern not to have the war at all. Now, if you compare our time, we saw the Abu Ghraib revelations, the photos in spring 2004. But what we did with those is very different. We never questioned whether we should be at war. We didn't stop any war, especially not this new form of war with drones and special forces, but we did clean it up. And so it's that outcome I'm concerned about. And I'm wondering, do we need to care more about some of the rules we've neglected that are supposed to keep us from being at war except when absolutely necessary, and put in their place the rules that are about keeping our wars less brutal, even if they're endless?
What does it mean, the fact that we don't really, even in Congress, debate war or using force very often? In other words, we'll use something that goes back 20 years to justify certain actions that are very distant from the original reason that we authorized the attack in the first place. And then, of course, the American public, because only about 1% of the people are involved in the military, and they're being paid. Nobody's being conscripted into the military. So we're more distant. Here I live in the Northeast, as you do, and I would wonder how many college graduates ever put on a uniform here in the Northeast. And then when you look at the fact that, you know, these things go on, we don't win these wars, we conclude them by leaving unilaterally. I mean, there's no conclusion to anything, and there's no debate about anything.
These are all fundamental, you know, insights, Larry, and I think each of them deserves a lot of attention. You know, Congress has not declared a war since World War II. It briefly reasserted itself after Vietnam in passing the War Powers Act of 1973, but it's allowed presidents to basically sidestep it ever since. And so we really do have a kind of unilateral presidentialism in war that is, you know, it ought to be subjected to more democratic control. Now, the draft is a promising idea, but there are a couple of, you know, things we ought to say about it. One, we should never forget that elites could avoid service even when it existed. Mm-hmm. And this new form of war I'm talking about relies less and less on troops, whether conscripted or volunteer. So if we're going to try to kind of put a leash on these wars or rein them in somehow, it seems like in a sense we're on our own. We have to find some other way of proceeding. And I think it's promising, as some of our political candidates have, just to point out how much they cost at a time when, you know, American growth isn't the same as what it was, but its needs do grow. If we imagine what could have been done with the trillions spent on the war on terror with regard to health or infrastructure, I hope it's an appealing message enough, appealing enough to Americans for them to moderate their fears of, you know, foreign threats and really go back to that period in the 1940s when they ended up getting more of a warfare state than a welfare state. And I think, you know, the social tragedies we hear about every day are ones that, you know, can motivate returning to that choice and making it a little differently.
There are so many things in this book that you say that will really alert somebody who's paying attention. You say that after the Cold War, U.S. presidents ordered not fewer, but more wars. More than 80% of all U.S. military interventions abroad since 1946 came after 1989. Now, there we were, the singular superpower on the globe, a unipolar. You tell us that basically Bill Clinton's presidency did the most to drive the drift into militarism. And again, I think most people would be stunned at that. I mean, they think of Rwanda, of course, and that was not a good situation. But they think of Kosovo and Bosnia and such, and give him a lot of credit for going in there. Explain what you were saying about Bill Clinton's presidency.
George Herbert Walker Bush was president when the Cold War ended, and he fought the Gulf War. But it came at a time when people were hoping to see a kind of reset. People spoke of a peace dividend. People wondered whether it was necessary for the Cold War military budget and the Cold War basing to which you referred needed to continue. Bill Clinton came into office famously as someone who hadn't served in the military and was skittish at the beginning about American force. But by the end of his term, he'd done some very important things for the future. One was to respond to humanitarian need and violate international law to bomb Kosovo, which many people now see as like a dry run for what George W. Bush was to do in Iraq. But there was also the faintest stirrings of counterterrorism. There was the kind of Iraq bombing that Clinton conducted, Operation North and South Watch, but there was also the the pursuit of Osama bin Laden that he initiated. Now, after 9/11, Clinton was blamed for failing to get Osama bin Laden, understandably. But we already see there in his administration the kind of weakening constraints on beginning to conduct what comes to be a targeted killing regime under George W. Bush and Barack Obama. And that's kind of the legal source of the counterterrorism we've been talking about with drones and special forces in our time.
How differently have we defined major war, meaning among major powers, versus those against colonial interests or subjugating people of color around the world, or counterterrorism against a non-state actor? Because all these are so murky, and yet there's a clear pattern that we look at one with a lot more horror and disdain than we do the other.
That's right. So the wars on the peripheries, especially when they've been in colonial circumstances for Europeans, or even in the Philippines for our country, or after World War II in our global Cold War fighting, those have sometimes been proxy wars, but even when American troops were involved, were regarded a bit differently unless they involve massive escalation, as in Korea, as in Vietnam. And you know, Vietnam obviously became very unpopular, really a kind of unique event, and drove a lot of creative thinking, including the peace candidacy of George McGovern and the War Powers Act of 1973, which I mentioned. But you're right that since the end of the Cold War, there have been these big full dress interventions, and Americans do tend to get concerned about them when they go south. It's no accident that torture in Abu Ghraib and elsewhere was so upsetting when it was revealed, at the very time it was clear that Iraq was hard to govern and the occupation wasn't going well. The trouble is, for these shadowy wars, now more humane and less visible and more tolerable because they're humane, you know, we are just much less likely to get upset about those. We don't fight them with a lot of risk, especially with drones, since there's just a man with a joystick and with no risk of coming home in a body bag. And there are minimal casualties in special force deployments too on the American side. And so in those circumstances, these shadowy wars that have now been made more humane just seem very hard to get people to consider, even though they have grievous effects and they commit us to, you know, buy a lot of weaponry, spend a lot of time surveilling a lot of people who may or may not be involved in terrorism, usually not.
By the way, in your book, and just as a sidebar, it was fascinating that the Korean War, which again is almost the forgotten war, was the most intense war, and the one where there were more casualties per year and person involved than any of our other wars. I found that startling. But you also say that George H.W. Bush, the Gulf War, was the first genuine attempt, Desert Storm, at a humane war. And he said, you quoted him, that the specter of Vietnam has been buried in the desert sands. Now, to some extent, I mean, maybe he's right. That kind of war is not going to happen again. We're not going to lose 50,000 American soldiers. But that doesn't mean that we're not again involved in wars like in Iraq and Afghanistan, where at least at the beginnings of those wars under George W. Bush, there were lots of civilians who were killed. Maybe we've been getting better at humane war since,
right,
but we still had a lot of collateral damage that we don't talk about or think about.
Absolutely. So, you know, all I mean by humane war is that, first of all, there are cause groups like Human Rights Watch that begin monitoring our wars for whether they are in conformity with the law. And then the military itself. himself after Vietnam took on board the responsibility to follow the law. I mean, in ways that would have been unimaginable in Vietnam or definitely Korea, since as you reported, it was really like the most brutal war on both sides that America has fought. Now, that's not to say that the wars are humane, because the rules are pretty permissive. Lots of civilians in Iraq in particular died not being shot at by Americans, but in civil disorder and unrest. But the rules, even when Americans are doing the shooting, allow a lot of death, for sure, and injury. What struck me, though, is that as those wars become unpopular and presidents begin to pull out troops and shift to the shadow war, they almost double down on the promise to keep the war humane. There's an amazing speech that Obama gives in 2013 at the National Defense University, where he says that he will go beyond what the law of war requires, which is merely that if you're shooting at a target, the advantage you gain has to outweigh the collateral damage you expect, including civilian death. And Obama said, we will never strike outside kind of hot battlefields with drones or special forces if we anticipate anyone innocent to suffer. And it struck me that, you know, he's making that promise because, you know, saying that the drones are humane reassured Americans, and promising that special forces would isolate the innocent before they kill the guilty reassures Americans in some way that mattered, or that he thought mattered enough to sustain the wars. And so that's why I thought it's worth a book, because no one has written about that particular thing.
In closing, I heard someone on the left today, in talking about the 20th anniversary of 9/11, suggest that a world that is a guaranteed peace, if you will, by the United States is a better place than allowing, of course, China or someone else to do that. Now, we are still the reigning superpower, but I think there's a lot of question as to how quickly the Chinese are catching up. Some people would say that the world might have been a better place when we had a standoff between the Soviet Union and the United States, and we really focused our efforts on that. What is it that allows the world to kind of look at us, recognize our foibles, recognize that we've gone in places we had no business going into, and yet they still kind of allow America to roam the world? I know people don't want to think that we're the world's policemen, but aren't we?
We are by default. You know, Europeans accepted our protection in the Cold War and have never rebuilt their armies. The Russians have a lot of might, but it's a regional might. I mean, they clearly know how to interfere globally the way the Soviets did. But remember, even the Soviets directly intervene only in their own neighborhood in Eastern Europe and, and Afghanistan, where America, through the Cold War, was intervening globally with its own military. And so there's really no rival. The novelty in this equation, of course, is China. And it's very interesting that Biden has been justifying the withdrawal from Afghanistan on the grounds that the new agenda is confrontation with China. Now, that's not to suggest that he or others think there's a new Cold War coming or that it'll take military form. But, you know, military power follows wealth. And, you know, our country is doesn't have the wealth relative to the rest of the world that it once did. And China is getting richer. And so, you know, the future is unknown. We could imagine the return to brutal war, even world wars. For now, we're living in a world where, as you say, America has the weaponry and it follows the rules. And the question is, do we want to tolerate the kind of war we've seen invented in our time, this new humane form of war?
What a great way to wrap up our conversation. I really appreciate it because I think you're going to lend some new perspective to people's thinking about this topic, and congratulations on this incredible work. Samuel Moyne, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. Thank you for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you, Larry.